Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello once again, and welcome to My Time Capsule. My name's Mike Fenton-Stevens. And in this podcast, I talk to various people about the five things from their life that they would like to put into a time capsule. Four things that they cherish and want to preserve, and one that they would like to bury in the ground and never visit again. My guest this week is Chris Addison. Chris started his career as a stand-up comic, appearing at the Edinburgh Festival for, well, a number of years, and he was a regular performer on the comedy panel show Mock the Week. But he's probably best known for playing Ollie Reader in The Thick of It, and a similar character in the film In the Loop, called Toby Wright. He's also a director and producer. He won an Emmy as executive producer of Armando Iannucci's Veep, the brilliant HBO sitcom starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, for which he also won a Directors Guild of America award. In 2019, he directed the film The Hustle with Rebel Wilson and Anne Hathaway, a role reversal remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And recently, he's been back in Britain as the director and producer of the comedy Breeders, which he co-created with the show's main writer, Simon Blackwell, and its star, Martin Freeman. I spoke to Chris at his home in London. Well, he was in his home and I was in mine, social distancing by about 50 miles, just to be on the safe side. So, let's find out what five things Chris Addison would like to put into his time capsule. I hope you enjoy it.
When I thought about this, it's quite a hard thing to think about, actually. I always find myself, when people go, tell me a funny story about that thing, I always go, I can't remember anything about my life. If anybody ever tried to get me to write my autobiography, it would be hopeless. It would be either just incredibly vague or very short, because I can never remember those things. And I thought about what are the things that I've loved and the moments that I've sort of felt exceptional. And the first thing that I want to put in, these are not in chronological order, but the first thing, I'd like to put the smell of the brewery in Edinburgh into this time capsule. I don't know if we can capture it in some kind of bottle.
Yeah, I think we probably can.
But that malty smell, if you've never been to Edinburgh, if the wind is blowing in the right direction, the entire city smells of malt. It smells sort of like they're baking Weetabix or something. Or it's a really smells can't be oleaginous, but if they could, that's what this smell would be. There's a sort of comfortingness to it, and there's a sort of roundness, and it's lovely. It doesn't smell like booze. It doesn't smell like beer. It smells like malt. And the reason that I want to put that in is that Edinburgh has been such an important part, or was such an important part of my life for years and years and years. I worked out, actually, that over the course of my life, I've spent over a year of it in Edinburgh in total. Yeah. at the festival. And the first time I ever went up to the Edinburgh Festival, I went up as a punter in 92, I think, in 1992. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it must have been 92. Summer of 92. I went up for a week with my best mate, Gav. We stayed in our friend Anshuman's flat. Anshuman lived, he was at Edinburgh University, and we stayed over in his flat. And we did that proper kind of young Edinburgh punter thing where we ran around the city to as many shows as we possibly could. This was in the days as well where shows were like £3 and £4.
Yeah.
Not as they are now, although the Free Fringe has changed things a bit, hasn't it? But still, we had a schedule. We ran around seeing everything that we possibly could, comedy, theatre, everything. And I'd never been anywhere like it. And it was the most thrilling place because it's alive. It's buzzing, that town, with creativity and excitement and people having the time of their lives. There are some people there who are having a horrible time, it must be said, but still the time of their lives. For all of that week that we went, the wind happened to be blowing in that direction, and Edinburgh smelt of malt. And when I first turned up, I just thought it was a strange atmosphere. It was just the town's atmosphere. It was just what this place smelled of. I'd never noticed that other cities smelled of anything, but this one seemed to. And then the next year, I remember going back and something was missing. I couldn't put my finger on it. And for sort of 2 days, I was thinking, oh, this is an example of never go back because it's just not working out. And then the wind changed. And I went, oh, that's what it is. Suddenly, Edinburgh felt like Edinburgh again. So for me, that smell is, it's a really comforting, homely smell. It's a proper, yeah, I absolutely adore getting off the train at Edinburgh and getting my first faceful of that because it brings back memories from the best part of 20 years.
Yeah.
Of
Where did you first stay when you went up there? Which part of Edinburgh?
We stayed over the meadows in Marchmont Road in that sort of in the tenement flats.
That's my favourite bit.
It's great, isn't it?
It's my favourite bit.
Yeah.
Just across the meadows, beautiful.
Oh, it's wonderful. And you know, we were in our very early 20s at that point, and so we were up all night walking across the meadows at dawn back home for a couple of hours kit before we began again, and it was thrilling. I mean, we did stay in some terrible places over the years. That year we'd gone up as a punter, and we just stayed in our mate's flat. But then a couple of years later, with a theatre company from university, we took up some very serious plays, very, very important and extremely terrible, terrible productions. I mean, we put them onto, you know, no people. But we stayed, our theatre company stayed in, it was on a badminton court.
Oh, my God.
So we had beds on a badminton court. It was bunk beds and stuff. It was a youth club run by this extraordinary man called Mr. Fisher. who said, I only have two rules. I can't remember what the rules were because, in fact, he had many, many more rules, which were just sub-rules posted all over the, you know, all over the place. He wanted to look after our moral souls, which is not what students of 21 really want to happen. He used to sort of come in and take an inventory of who was a dirty stop-out. But he basically put out a load of camp beds all over his youth club's badminton court. And that is where we stayed, in this sort of makeshift dormitory,
yeah.
like flood victims.
For £5,000 a week.
Yeah. Yeah, for an astonishing amount of money. That's right. But I think at that age, it's all just part of the excitement, isn't it? I mean, you walk everywhere in Edinburgh anyway. It's the most beautiful city. It must be kind of, it's properly up there as one of the world's most beautiful cities. It's astonishing. And so, you know, you're full of the joys of everything that's happening at that age.
Yeah.
It was, you know, later on I became slightly more cynical about the process. And the last time I did a show there, which is 10 years ago now, you know, by that time I was there with a young family staying in a new town in a flat as far away from the madness as I possibly could. But then it didn't matter. You just wanted to just get your hands dirty. Stay at the Fringe Club all night, you know.
Yeah, I have some terrible theatrical experiences in those early days. Really terrible. I did a play called The Lorenzaccio Story, which had Tim McInerney was in it.
Oh, yeah.
And an actor called Nigel LeVaillant. And we performed this thing, and there was a scene in it where the director, a director called Jeremy Howe, I think is now head of BBC Drama or something. I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, I know one of those people. That's what happens to people. Not me. I'm just an actor still.
No one's just an actor, yeah, Mike.
Just an actor. I had to do a scene with Tim where we stood in front of the rest of the cast, and there were about 15 of them, and they were all stark bollock naked on the stage.
Oh, no.
And we once did that to an audience of three.
Yeah.
One of whom was my to-be wife, who was knitting because she was pregnant.
Embarrassed or bored?
Pregnant and bored.
Yeah.
And the other one was a woman who clearly had come in to see the wrong show. And not only that, one of the members of the cast had the most enormous penis you've ever seen. And so it was pointless doing this scene in front of him because nobody was looking at us at all.
Yeah. Could you tone that thing down a bit? Yeah. Is there anything that you could do?
Just tuck it away somewhere.
Dip it in something cold before we start. Yeah. The first performance that I did in Edinburgh, we did a double act, an ill-advised double act at a sea venue on them, which used to be at the Royal Overseas House on Princess Street. They had a slot going and they wanted to know if we could fill it. So we said, yeah, we'll do a comedy thing. And it was 9 o'clock in the morning. That was the slot. So it was doing a comedy double act. And you don't know at 22 or whatever, you don't know how ridiculous that is. And that's clearly not going to work. So I can remember marching across the meadows very, very early in the morning to go to Princess Street and set this show up, and we put everything in place, all the props that we needed. The show, by the way, was terrible. I mean, it was terrible. It was written in like 2 weeks and not tested and just awful. And we set all the props up, and we got our friend Mark, who was doing all the sound, was sorted everything out, and then we hid behind the curtain ready, and then the walk-on music came on. We walked on, and there was one person, and it was the friend whose flat we were staying in. But we still did the show. We still did it.
Of course, yeah.
But I used to tell that story as though we were the heroes for doing the show, and it's only in recent years that I thought, Christ, he was the hero for just sort of sitting there and allowing us to do that.
Yeah.
Sitting there with a rictus grin for an hour. Poor bugger. Anyway. We're still in touch, so it can't have been so dreadful.
No. I have very fond memories of those things because they are so absurd. We did a Sylvia Plath thing, which was terrible. It had three women, all doing Sylvia Plath stuff, and me and a fellow called David Jackson Young. We sat on white boxes in black leotards and narrated her life.
Wow.
It was just... Oh, it was so awful.
Wow. I mean,
awful.
But you're a man who has a background in comedy, so you must know the absurdity of that as soon as it... Because there are certain actors who would not know the absurdity of that.
No, they think they look great. But I knew, we both knew, David and I, we both knew. In fact, once we were about to go on stage, and he said to me, you know, Sylvia Plath left a suicide note, don't you? I said, no. He said, yeah, it said, dear Ted, your dinner's on the table, your wife's in the oven.
that's a dark joke.
That's a dark joke. And at that moment, being so tired and so fed up and so hungover, I found it the funniest thing I'd ever heard. And at that moment, we walked on stage. And there is a review somewhere saying that they thought it was rather moving that one of the narrators spent the entire play with his head in his hands.
It worked out. That's hilarious. But so how long was that run? How long were you condemned to sit on those white boxes in your black leotards?
4 weeks.
Oh, my word. That's brutal.
Oh, I know. The things you do when you're a student and a lot of drink.
And a lot of drink, yeah. Well, that's the part of it. I remember bumping into Sean Locke. How long ago would this have been? To think it was at the Pleasance, so it would have been like early 2000s. I remember bumping into Sean Locke on the last night of the festival and saying to him, hello Sean, I haven't seen you around all festival. And he went, I'm 36. And I thought, I get it. And a few years later, I remember thinking, I can't be doing that anymore. And I used to go, and in those days I used to then go to FOP, the fantastic cheapy CD and DVD shop, and buy myself like £3 DVDs, curate myself a film festival so that I could just do the show, go home, watch the thing, go to bed, because after a while it takes its toll. But those early years when you've got all the energy in the world, there's nothing better. And the other thing is that it's also because stand-up is such a sort of solitary existence, you can go a long time without seeing your pals, really, and your colleagues. And Edinburgh is a big party because for a month you're all in the same place, which is great. It's absolutely lovely. It's like sort of the tribe coming back together. But it's an odd I mean, it's definitely odd. I still know, even if I go to Edinburgh, I have a Pavlovian response to it. I can feel the sort of acidy, battery acid tang of adrenaline in the back of my mouth as I walk through that city, because it's just, I'm conditioned now for after years and years and years to feeling that fear, the fear of the sort of intensity of that time.
Well, we're going to put the lovely smell of malt wafting through the air. The entire capsule will be full of that smell.
Stinking.
It's a lovely smell. It is a nice smell.
It's a lovely smell. My friend who I mentioned, my Bessie, he was at school in York between a sugar beet factory, sugar beet refinery, and round trees. So depending on which way the wind was blowing, it would either the school would smell of chocolate or the worst smell in the world.
Lovely. Okay. So that's number one. We put number one into the time capsule. What's next?
Next is another sort of earlier thing. And it's a gig. It's a music gig. And it's the band The House of Love playing at Manchester Polytechnic on the 31st of October, 1988, supported by East Village. And the reason for that is, so my mate Bill, who I was at school with, changed my sort of music brain. And he did that by, I was quite late to pop music. I grew up in a house where my dad listened to a lot of classical music, and his mum used to listen to a lot of that stuff as well. And there was pop music around and stuff, but I sort of latched onto that. And I started quite late. I started listening to pop properly when I was about 13, 14, something like that. Mm. And I started listening to Queen. I was a huge fan of the enormously blousy, ridiculous band Queen, to the point where I was in the fan club as a kid and stuff. Like I at that point I had enough pocket money to save up and every two or three weeks be able to buy an album, and I bought their vinyl over that time. I just listened to them. And then at the age of 16, my friend Bill lent me a copy of an album by The House of Love, who were a band. Their sound was that sort of late 80s, very jangly indie pop. The sound's quite a broad, spready sound. It just, it's not very precise. It's quite fuzzy, I suppose. Mm. And it sort of blew my mind. I'd never heard anything quite like it. And I remember listening to he lent me the record. I remember listening to it through that evening and not quite understanding what I'd heard, and then re-listening to it immediately. And it sort of changed. It opened a whole other world to me that I'd never experienced, of this sort of indie pop thing. And it turned out I really loved that stuff. And then shortly after that, that was at the sort of the beginning of my first year of sixth form, I think. And shortly after, it was Bill's birthday. And for his birthday, we went, him and me and our mate Chris Thomas, went to see this band play at Manchester Poly. And I feel like it was a moment in my life that was the beginning of a different stage. It's almost like the beginning of young adulthood in lots of ways.
Yeah.
Because it was the first gig that I'd ever been to. I'd never experienced anything like that with music that was quite new to me, that I'd fallen for in the way that you can only fall for music, really, and at that age. The thing that illustrates for me how much it was a bridge between two ages was that, first of all, we went to Bill's house where his lovely, lovely parents cooked us a roast. We had a roast dinner. for his birthday, then got on the bus, went into town with fake IDs, and went to this gig. And I smoked my first cigarette. I'm not condoning smoking, kids, but we smoked cheekily on the upstairs of the bus. I remember buying, not knowing what to buy, so at the bar, so ordering Guinness because I'd heard of Guinness, and it coming in those sort of floppy plastic cups that they serve you at gigs. And I can remember that, the smell and the dry ice and the sweat and the mosh pit and all of those things. And it was a completely new experience for me. I remember the next day, the sort of tinnitus in my ears, the fact that I could not hear above this incredible ringing. But something had properly changed. I mean, I'd never seen a band live. I loved how close we could be to them. I loved the whole live experience of of being in that room. Because of course, being a small band, it was a small room. It wasn't like seeing somebody at the Apollo or the Empire or the O2 or something like that. It was right up close with the band, and it properly changed my life. And I still think of it as right in my top gigs.
Yeah. It's very strange, isn't it, that experience of going to a gig and for the first time. It's quite frightening, really, because you feel as if you're an imposter.
Absolutely. To the point where, I can remember walking in with the fake ID that we'd all bought fake IDs, these fake NUS cards that were going around school for five. You had to go and get a picture taken, and then they would sell you the fake ID plus the sort of laminated pocket that the ID would go in. And you had to iron. I remember you had to iron the thing shut. So all the, by the time you got out, it would all be peeling apart, and you'd hope no one could. But I remember handing over the ID to get into the Mandela building, at Manchester Poly, as was Manchester Met now. And just feeling like I felt like I was in the end of The Great Escape. I felt like I was handing over my papers, and the border guards were very likely to get me.
Oh, yeah. Safe journey, Johnny.
Yeah. Thank you.
Ah, no.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I'm 14. Oh, no.
And it's not like everybody was taller at that point by that time in our lives, but still, it just felt like, you're right, everybody knew what they were doing. I was that age where students felt impossibly old, even though they were only 2 years older than me. That felt when you're a kid and every year counts for so much in terms of how it feels people are advanced compared to you. And I returned to see plenty of gigs there over the years. But that one was, it properly changed my way of, listening to music. It changed the kind of music that I listened to. And it was my first sort of grown-up night out. It was my first sort of adult adventure. And it was the beginning of the sort of transition from being a kid to being a grown-up, which lasts quite a long time, that transition. Yes. Lasts longer than imagine. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I think I always thought, you get to 18 and then something happens, but of course it doesn't. It takes a long time to figure that stuff out. But that was the beginning for me. And still, even now, the opening track of that album, Christine, is regularly on my sort of playlists.
Brilliant. I've never been very adventurous with music, I have to admit. All my experiences have been other people sort of forcing me to listen to things.
Yeah.
I wish I'd found the band that I loved. Actually, I did have the experience of pretending to be
I was going to say, what about the heebie-jeebies?
Well, that was the thing that was joyous about that was not necessarily pretending to be the Bee Gees, because I never really wanted to be a Bee Gee. But we used to do a Status Quo parody track.
Oh.
And it's always been my favorite thing, because without meaning to, an audience comes to see a show that they think is going to be a comedy show. And it was a comedy show. And we play a song that is very silly and everybody laughs at it, but they can't help but react as if it's a Status Quo song. So if you do it in a gig situation, people start to move and they start to bop and their heads go. And it's absolutely brilliant to be on stage. You know you're pretending, but people are caught up in that thing. They can't help it.
Yeah, that's the power of a beat, isn't it? It's really hard to avoid doing something. You've got to work quite hard to not react to some sort of beat that's playing, I think. But also there's the fact that we as people from the world of comedy have always traditionally basically wanted to be musicians.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's ever so late that you can't find the band or the thing, because actually I think that a really important thing is to be able to remain open to changes in music or your musical taste. That doesn't mean you have to sort of slavishly follow whatever the fashion is, but finding new things is really important. Simon Blackwell, who I've known for years, we've worked on Thick of It and Veep and Trying Again and now Breeders. He always says that the danger is that if you stop, if you decide that's it, culture is, I'm full culturally, no further submissions will be taken at this point. That's when you kind of ossify and you stiffen up, and that's how old age sets in, the refusal to change and the refusal to accept the new. You can become dead old, dead young. Yes. By doing that. And I think if you remain open to lots of different kinds of cultural experience and different ways of experiencing things as well, then you can stay a bit lither and younger.
Yeah, I discovered something recently, and I was embarrassed by it, in fact, because a friend of mine died, a man called Andy Gill. I liked him a lot. He was a really lovely man, very funny, very quiet and dry sense of humour.
Yeah.
And he died, sadly. And we went to the funeral, and the band that he was in, the remaining members, played along with a track of his guitar playing.
Wow.
That they'd taken from a session. And he was in a band called Gang of Four.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know anything about Gang of Four, but right. I'd never bothered to look it up. I'd never bothered to find out what he did. And I heard this music at this funeral and thought, bloody hell, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I'd known this man for a long time, but had no sense of what he actually did. He wasn't bothered about what he'd done. He didn't want me to necessarily know it. We talked about other things.
But that's, I quite like that. I mean, you shouldn't be defined by what you do unless you want to be defined by what you do. I remember reading a thing Buzz Aldrin had said after going to Neil Armstrong's funeral. He said, they mainly talked about how much he enjoyed golf. Which, said, I didn't even know he liked golf. But I find that charming that the people who went to Neil Armstrong's funeral would go, yeah, he did. Obviously he did the moon thing. We know that. But he really liked. That's great.
That's good. All right, well, I'm going to put that gig into the time capsule.
That'd be
lovely. We're going to take a short break here for some adverts. We'll be back very shortly.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back. Let's return to this episode of My Time Capsule with Chris Addison and find out what else he'd like to put into his time capsule. So we've got three more things to put into the time capsule.
Okay. The next thing is a family of elephants. And it's a specific family of elephants. And this family of elephants live in the Ruaha region of Tanzania. And last year, finally, I was very lucky to be able to go with my family on safari. So I've never done that before. We went, I have two kids, and we took them for 6 days to safari and then
really?
To go and relax somewhere for a bit.
Lovely.
After that. We thought 6 days was as much as they could cope with. We were wrong about that. They would happily have spent 4 months just going around doing that, I think. We flew to Dar es Salaam, the capital of Tanzania, and then from there we flew to an airstrip in the Ruaha, and we were picked up in one of those sideless jeeps by the people from the camp where we were staying, an amazing place on the other side of the park. And so there's a longish drive from the airport to where you're camped, and none of us had ever been to sub-Saharan Africa before. None of us had ever been in that sort of environment before. And as we were driven by our guides across the park, we had to stop because there was a family of elephants in front of us. And it was, that's a very simple fact, but it was one of the most astonishing things that I've ever experienced or witnessed, just to see something that you've seen all your life, largely, you know, images of on the television, on documentaries or what have you, or occasionally at a zoo, maybe even at a safari park, to see it living in its house, you know, living in the world, just existing like it's normal to be an elephant. That was genuinely mind-blowing. And there were so many of them. There were really elderly ones, very young ones, a big old load of them. And what I love about that moment, there are two things that I love about that moment. One is the sheer wonder of seeing something like that, the unexpected one, the fact that that's one of those moments in life where you can intellectualize that as much as you want, but nothing can prepare you for the actuality of it happening. Yeah. There will be some aspect of it that you could never have thought of. That's the obvious one of those is having a child. You know, you can read all the books, you can do all the classes, you can do everything you want. But as my kid's godfather said, one minute you don't have a child, the next minute you do, and nothing in the world can prepare you for that. And but that seeing those creatures, that was the first of, you know, of sort of 6 days of genuine wonder. And the second thing that I like about it is the fact that me and my wife and our two children experienced exactly that feeling at exactly the same time. Wow. That we were in a space, like in a physical and mental space all together at one moment. And that's not that regular an occurrence, is it, in life?
No.
With the people who mean most to you, something genuinely phenomenal happens and you're all there and all together in every respect. Mm. And that whole trip was just remarkable. It was full. You never got bored of seeing even things that are there all the time. Like it turned out that giraffes, you can see a giraffe anytime you want. They're just, there's millions of them and they're perfectly happy to come and look at you as you pass by, but you never get bored of seeing something that wonderful right in front of your in front of your face.
Did your kids almost react as if, how the hell did you do that, Dad? You know, because you think, so I'm going to get on a plane, we're going to fly to Africa, then we're going on a little plane and fly somewhere, get in a Jeep, and do you know what? While we're here, we might see some elephants.
Yeah.
And then about 20 minutes later, there they are.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I don't think that kids react in that way. Because I think that, so the story that always tells this best for me is that I took my goddaughter, Emily, who is now in her 20s, when she was four, five maybe, took her to the London Palladium to see Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, right? Mm. And the stage musical of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is fantastic. And the big moment, of course, is when the car flies, because how can you make a car fly? It's insane. Yeah. And it's done brilliantly, by the way. They have a fabulous sort of hydraulic arm, and it's lit very cleverly so that there are lights coming off the arm towards the car, but nothing underneath it.
Yeah.
So it just looks like the thing is flying, and then it will go out into the audience and come back. It is absolutely remarkable. And every single adult in that place was going, look at that. I mean, mind's blown. Every child was going, well, of course it flies. It's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. What are we talking about? Like, there's no sense of wonder at it. So because we've explained to them that that's the normality. I think you have to, you need quite a lot of context before you start to go, wow, that's amazing. Because we've spent ages going, this is normal to the children.
If you tell them something extraordinary is going to happen and then it does happen, they go, yep.
Yeah.
Because the world is full of those sort of things.
Yeah, absolutely. You spend your life telling them sort of fairy stories and all those things. At a point where they can't really differentiate between fiction and reality.
No.
And they don't know, they don't really have any expectations. So they don't know what's incredible and what's not incredible.
Well, you're very lucky then that your children's reaction to it, you had a joint reaction to this thing, rather than them going, yeah, you said elephants, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why that moment is so sort of precious. It is the part that tells the whole of that entire sort of six-day experience. But it was, my daughter had her birthday whilst we were out there, and we had to, you know, you leave camp before dawn, and then they do breakfast. So you'll get a table out the back of the Jeep, and you're in the middle of the savannah where wildebeest run past eating, you know, eating Rice Krispies and singing happy birthday. I mean, it's unbelievable. I'm so aware as parents are of the fact that childhood is, Jeremy Dyson said to me once, parenthood is a series of little griefs, because your children are getting your mourning stages all the time. You know, I can't pick my kids up anymore. And that's a shame, isn't it? That was a lovely thing. And I've got these fabulous humans in return for paying that price. But so you're aware as a parent how time is pressing.
Yeah, and you do end up really treasuring those trips.
Our time is very, very limited. And our time going away together as four people is highly limited. So, you know, that stuff is really precious.
Okay, well, I'm going to put that gorgeous herd of elephants into the time capsule for you, Chris.
Okay.
So now you've got one good, one bad.
One good, one bad. So, the bad one is, I was in a film a few years ago called The Look of Love, and it was a biopic of Britain's foremost pornographer and richest man, Paul Raymond, as played by Steve Coogan. And I played a guy called Tony Power. And Tony Power was the man who sold Raymond the idea of porn mags, basically. Raymond had the Raymond Review Bar and these strip clubs and stuff. And this guy, Tony Power, came to him in the early 70s and said, "You can make money with Mucky Books." And he ran Raymond's magazine empire for a long time until it became so chaotic that he was sacked. Anyway, I played that part, and we were directed by the brilliant Michael Winterbottom, who is a fascinating director and a really exciting one to work with as an actor, because he's constantly moving. It's very kinetic and frenetic, his set. You know, a lot of film sets are very boring, and you do an awful lot of waiting around, an awful lot of hanging around whilst lighting is done and camera positions are set and everything's very precise, and you have to do the same lines over and over and over again for many different setups, and it can take a long time. Depending on the film and the budget and so on, it's not unusual to just get through three pages of a script in a day, for example. But the way that Michael likes to shoot is completely different. He is an impatient director, and he wants to move on quickly, and he gets you to improvise an awful lot of stuff. He likes to just throw you into situations and see what happens. He's got two cameras running. There's minimal lighting, although the film still looked beautiful, to cut down on that sort of waiting time thing. He's so full of energy, and it rubs off on the films. It's very exciting from that point of view. One of the things that he does, because he likes to work in an unusual way and he is impatient, is that with the film, you would have a schedule, wouldn't you? With a film, what normally happens is that the first assistant director has broken the film down into the number of days that you need to shoot it and how you put those scenes together in an order that makes them practical to shoot, and so on and so on and so on. So everybody knows that you're going to start on, for example, the 1st of April and go from there. But Michael had his schedule, but he just wanted to shoot. He just wanted to shoot. Right, so let's just do a day's shooting before the shoot. Let's do a day's shooting. Okay. Okay, we'll do a day's shooting. Yeah, we'll do some scenes. We'll do some scenes where they're doing photo shoots for the magazines. He doesn't like to say action. He just sort of, you suddenly realize that the scene is taking place and you're in it. And I'm already a real fish out of water in this show, because the part that I'm playing is a massive cokehead pornographer, and I am an embarrassed middle class boy who has never done coke. In fact, I had a conversation with my wife before we started to film this, saying I don't know how to play it, because you know, he's coked up the whole time, and that's not something I've experienced. I don't want to experience that, to research it particularly. And she's taught me, with Chris, other people use cocaine to get like you are normally. Okay, fine. Okay, all right. I can deal with that.
Yeah.
So I've been taught to take this stage coke, which is an extraordinary. Have you ever taken any of that stuff?
No. It's
horrific. So you have to sort of hoover it up.
So you can really snort it.
Yeah, you can snort it. So in fact, the art director, a week before the shoot, I was in the production offices getting a beard fitted, and the art director stopped me and went, "Ah, good, good. I'm glad I've seen you. He said, I wanted you to choose some of these. And he took out of his pocket a series of sort of pipes and devices for taking, like, you know, silver things for serious cokeheads. And I went, oh, okay. So which do you think your character would have? I don't know. So I just pointed at one. And then he held up a little baggie of white powder and went, and this is stage cocaine. And I said, great. Right. What's in it? He went, I have no idea. He sort of, I went, I'll be honest with you, Henry. I've never done this. I've never chopped out a line. I've never seen anybody chop out a line. I have a very sheltered life for somebody in my line of work, clearly. But I don't know how it's done. How is it done? He said, well, neither have I, but I believe. and then he poured some out on the desk and started to chop it out. And it was only at that moment that I realized that on the desk was a series of research pictures. There was Paul Raymond did a shoot of his ex-wife, Jean, a few years after they divorced, of her on this sort of naked shoot of her on a stuffed tiger, which was being replicated in the film. So for research purposes, there were photocopies of the original photo shoot all over this desk. And he was chopping out this stage coke on it. And I looked behind me and I realized that we were on the ground floor and there's a window directly behind us that people could see it. And we're surrounded by porn chopping out what looks to anybody like coke on this desk. And I was thinking, this doesn't feel like the most advisable thing. Anyway, so about a week later, I was in those photo studios in Hackney where we were shooting Paul Raymond and Tony Power organizing some photo shoots. I didn't really know how any of this was going to work. At that point, I was just concentrating on trying to figure out how I'd chop this thing out. And then I realized that that we'd started and I didn't quite know what we were doing in this scene particularly. All I knew was there was a guy playing a photographer. I had to sort of direct him and there was a model. What I hadn't been told was that the model was a genuine porn model because you can't just get anybody to come in and do this. So this woman,
oh my God,
basically disrobed. I'm in the scene, so I can't ask any questions at this point. Disrobed entirely and then sort of squatted down. And I had to just improvise some instructions to her. And I was thinking, what do you say in these circumstances? What can you do? I mean, I've got to think like, you know, somebody for whom this is their bread and butter. They do this all the time. This isn't the most mortifying thing that's ever happened to them. And so I mean, it's a bit of a blur, I'll be honest with you. But I just sort of thought back to all the kind of jazz mags that used to be handed around at school and thought, right, and tried to sort of describe her some positions that she might helpfully get into. And I can remember being so horrified by the whole thing. And when Michael called cut, I picked up her robe and sort of thrust it towards her. And she took it with a sort of quizzical, slightly offended look and sort of draped it over a chair. Why do I need that? Because she's perfectly comfortable with what she's doing. She models that stuff all the time. It was absolutely, it was extraordinary. It only got worse.
Oh, no.
Because then in the afternoon, you might have to cut this out. In the afternoon,
oh God,
we replicated a shoot that Raymond had done where they were in sort of, as his magazines got sort of more and more squalid, there was a shoot. Oh, there was a shoot on it with two models on a snooker table on all fours, right? And I'm standing next to Coogan, who is less bashful about this, to nobody's great surprise. And these poor women who, you know, who, as I say, are kind of legitimate glamour models, they're in trouble because the fashion currently and then is that people shave their pubic hair, right? That's what you would expect now, but obviously not in the times when that we're replicating.
No.
So we had to have sort of merkins for them, pubic wigs, which is a thing that doesn't exist, by the way. Pubic wigs are not a readily available thing. So what the hair and makeup department had to do was get hold of some theatrical sideburns that you could stick on, sew two of them together and turn them upside down to form a sort of triangle and use that instead. So these poor women are contending with these things peeling off. And in the middle of the shoot, there's a bit in the script, this point where my character hands one of them a jar of Vaseline and says, could you just make it look a bit, you know, shinier? And but you know, Michael being Michael, the models haven't been completely told what is going to happen because he wants natural reactions, but they don't know what we're talking about. So this poor girl takes two fingers and just scoops out the largest amount of Vaseline I've ever seen and applies it to her colleague. Right. And I was going, well, that's clearly too much. So she scraped it off and offered it back.
Oh my God.
And I went, I don't know what to do with that. I was fully out of character there by that point, going, I don't know what to do with that, mate. And Coogan went, give it there. I thought, this ridiculous process can't get any worse. That was the most mortified I've ever been doing anything ever, I think. That whole day was extraordinary.
I can absolutely imagine it. Yes. No, I'm like you. Some people are very at ease with it, aren't they? And yeah. I'm the same. If ever I have to do any sex scenes, even just kissing, I'm really not very good at it.
It would be brilliant not to be British. It would be good. I often think about it. I just think it would be, I far prefer to be less uptight. Mm. But it's too late now. It was too late. Well, I had no idea what age that sets in, but it's way too late now. Still, that is the most, that whole shoot actually was extraordinary because we were replicating these extraordinarily hedonistic times. And Michael, I remember later on the day that we did those two mortifying scenes, there was a scene with me and Steve and Tamsin Egerton, and we were all supposed to be drinking. And the props guy came up to me and said, what's your tipple? And I went, oh, right. Well, I guess probably he'd be drinking whiskey, wouldn't he, in this situation? And he gave me, you know, the sort of the standard kind of tumbler finger of apple juice looking like whiskey. He turned over and started to shoot the scene. And I began to drink the apple juice. No, it's whiskey. It was whiskey. All the booze that we had for this entire shoot was real. And I can remember there was a wedding scene where we were just drinking champagne all day. It was me and Steve and David Williams and Imogen Poots and Anna Friel. And just drinking champagne all day. All the poor extras have got Schlur and appetizer. And we're drinking champagne all day. Absolutely roaring by the end of it, and it's the best wedding that I've ever been to because there were no politics in it. You know, there's no who should sit next to who. It's just a lot of people having a tremendous time. I can remember at the end of the 6-week shoot, Steve saying to me and James Lance, "Well, gentlemen," he said, "I've enjoyed flying with you." He said, "But I will be very glad to get out of this world." Because by the end of it, it was so sort of grim. The nightclub world of exploitation and drink. And by the end of it, it's interesting. I mean, I suppose in a way, Michael's technique worked because by the end of it, we were just, you know, we looked dreadful. We looked like people who had terrible habits, probably did have terrible habits by that point. But it was, I've never experienced anything quite like that.
Oh my God, that sounds awful. As a young man, I performed at the Raymond Review Bar.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's the venue for the comic strip.
That's right.
When it opened. So we used to go in there, and there would be one theatre that had strippers in it, and then the other theatre that had Alexis Sale in it.
Amazing.
How bizarre was that?
It is amazing.
Weird.
You sort of forget all of that stuff, that Soho existed. That Soho's sort of stopping now.
I think.
That street, Archer Street, that the Review Bar used to be on, one of my favourite things when we made the film, actually, was... There was one day when the art department basically recreated 1960s Soho down that street, and it was fantastic. It was just, it felt really, 1970s, I suppose, really thrilling to be down there. And now, of course, it's all, that's apartments, and as is everything. Madame Jojo's has gone around the back.
Yeah.
At least there's a new theatre there now, which is, that's a good thing. In that space, there's a theatre, which is good.
Oh, God. Okay, well, that excruciating film. It's locked away. It's locked away. It's gone.
Okay.
So finally, what have we got finally?
From the ridiculous to the sublime, really, this. So I would like to put in a suit of clothes that was made for me by the wardrobe department of the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden when I appeared in a speaking part, I must stress, in an opera called L'Étoile by Emmanuel Chabrier, on stage there, 4 years ago, I think, now.
Wow.
Which is one of the greatest stage experiences of my life. I absolutely loved it. I love opera. I'm a huge fan. And I think that's probably why they initially asked me if I would come and do a speaking part in this very little known French opera. And they also paid me, but I would not have needed paying. I would happily have gone and just done it just to hang out with those people. It was one of the thrills of my life, was to spend 3 weeks rehearsing and then over the course of a month, doing a few performances of this opera in a place that I love. Mm. And experiencing something on stage that I've never encountered, from the stage end rather than the auditorium end. It's remarkable. The scale of an opera production is unbelievable, because we as actors, we're used to going into rehearsal rooms where they've taped out stuff on the floor to show the basic shape of the set, and there might be a few poles to indicate where doors are, or that's it. You're just, until you get into the theatre for the technical rehearsal, that's fundamentally that's what you're dealing with.
Yeah,
not in the opera world. That it is remarkable. You have the full set in a rehearsal room for you to rehearse on from day one. So yeah, it's incredible. So that play, if you go into Covent Garden and you look at the Opera House from the Market Square in Covent Garden, so it's just in a corner. It's like squeezed into a little corner. There's a little door. Actually, that building is enormous. Not only does it contain a vast auditorium and a huge stage, but it has a scene dock where they keep those sets that is, you would happily, I mean, it looks like it's something from the Death Star. It looks like fighters, TIE fighters should be moored in there, basically. It's so huge. And on the other side of that dock are two rehearsal rooms with these enormous metal walls that go up that are full of full-sized opera sets, which is where you rehearse. And when it comes time for your opera to be put on stage, they wheel it, they push it physically out of the rehearsal room into the dock and then onto the stage. Because opera, unlike theatre performances, things at opera houses are always in rep. In other words, there's a different thing on every night, because it's very difficult for opera singers to be able to physically to sing the same part night after night after night. So they have a bunch of time to rest, which means that, La Boheme will be on one night, La Traviata will be on another night, and the Magic Flute will be on a third night. And they rotate those sets around. Mm. So that's why they have a huge scene dock. Each of those sets exists in that space with two others being rehearsed behind them. It was incredible. So to spend sort of 3 weeks in that room on that set with these remarkable singers who, when you're rehearsing, are singing like you've never heard anybody rehearse. I mean, just being up close to them and hearing a human able to make that noise is quite something. And what you don't realize whilst they're rehearsing is they're not at full power yet. And they're going to get to full power when you stand on stage with them. When you stand on stage and the audience are there, oh my goodness me. There was a point in the show where I used to have to stand and make it sound like it was a chore. It was an honor. I used to stand about a foot away from Kate Lindsay, who's this incredible mezzo-soprano, brilliant, brilliant singer. And she would be screaming in my face at full tilt. I mean, it is the most extraordinary experience. And so just from an actor's point of view, the sheer size of it was genuinely exciting. From a music fan's point of view, it was the thrill of my life. And also, as we touched on earlier, basically most comedians and actors want to be musicians. Mm. They're magicians, aren't they, really, musicians? It's wizardry what they can do.
Yes.
What that orchestra can do, if you like that, to see them work at it and to see it up close is a genuine privilege. The orchestra, you imagine that if an orchestra is going to do like a couple of Beethoven symphonies, that would be a few couple of weeks rehearsal, and it's not. It's not. I mean, they'll do 2 days maximum on something like that. And most of the ability to sight read is absolutely extraordinary. What they can do is, it's just mind-blowing. I did a show a couple of years ago with different opera company, Glyndebourne. I did a show on their tour about Behind the Curtain, which was sort of showing how an opera is put together sort of musically and as a production. And what I got them to do, because I was so amazed when I first saw an orchestra do it. I got them to commission for each of the shows that we did on the tour a different 90-second piece of music from a different composer that the orchestra could never have seen before in their lives, and then sight read it in front of the audience. And people used to go crazy because you've never seen anything like that. You've never seen skill like that. It's so well hidden.
Yeah.
The whole experience was amazingly good fun because it was basically being brought into this opera by the fantastic Mariam Clément, who directed it. Brilliant, brilliant director. To just make it madder and more fun. So to get in and to be able to sort of play with stuff, like we added jokes that involved the conductor and the orchestra. We just played with the form and all of those kinds of things. So to get to come in and do the stuff that you do, but in that context, it was, I'll never get to do anything like it again. And it was, it's one of my favourite things I've ever done.
Fantastic. Well, the only place you're going to get to do this again is in the time capsule, if you ever open it up and take it out.
I'm glad it's in there.
I bet you are. I'm very envious. That sounds a marvellous thing. I've tried to explain to my wife, who thinks opera is just people shouting. And I've tried to explain to her that sort of skill, if you get close to it, when you see it, you can't believe that a human body can make that much noise.
I think the reason that, we respond so viscerally to that is because at the same time, it's an incredibly human sound, and it's a superhuman sound. Mm. By no means everybody can make that noise, but there's something absolutely recognizable in us about it. And because it's at the pitch, it sort of hits you in the breastbone, really. It makes that bit vibrate. Mm. I think opera can often sound like just a bunch of people shouting, but if you hear the right thing in the right context, it's absolutely magical. There have been moments when I remember going to see Yestin Davies, who's an incredible countertenor. Countertenors sing very, very, very high. And he was in a production of a Handel oratorio called Saul. And he sings this line, "O King," he says. That's all he says. And he just sort of lifted up his head and began to sing it. And I can remember just gasping. The sound was so extraordinary. It was so unlike anything you've ever heard anybody do. That it hits you on a really, really basic human level.
Fantastic. I'm going to put the entire production in there.
Put Les Toiles there. Okay.
Well, Chris, it's been really lovely to talk to you, and it's really sweet of you to give me your time like this. So thank you very much.
Anytime.
Thank you very much for taking part in it.
It's an absolute pleasure. It really is. Thank you for asking me.
That was My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Chris Addison. It would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on Acast or wherever you prefer to get your podcasts from. And please, if you've got the time, leave a review and rate us. That would be very useful. And you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at MyTCPod, where you'll find extra content and behind-the-scenes photos. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Fenton Stevens. It's basically just a lot of pictures of my grandchildren. My Time Capsule is a cast-off production. Thank you for listening. If there is anybody still listening. I mean, why do people listen to this bit at the end? It goes on and on and on. Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.